From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Shatarupa Barua, broadcaster in VOA's Bangla service. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Our topic on this edition of the program, the global epidemic of violence against women. Our guest, Mary Ellsberg, the founding director of the Global Women's Institute at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. Despite the gains women have made in education, health, and even political power over the last 20 years, a new UN report reveals that violence against women and girls worldwide persists at alarmingly high levels. This violence transcends culture, ethnicity, and nationality. It occurs in the most developed as well as the least developed societies. From New Delhi and the much publicized gang rape of a young woman on a bus to conflict zones in South Sudan, Syria, and the DRC, where rape is used as a weapon of war, to Iraq, where jihadists enslave women for sex, to American college campuses and the U.S. military. Misogyny and violence against women seem to be on the rise. We'll talk with our special guest, Mary Ellsberg, who has more than 30 years of experience in international research and programs on gender and development, about this disturbing trend. Mary Ellsberg lived in Nicaragua for nearly 20 years, leading public health and women's rights advocacy. She has authored more than 40 books and articles on violence against women and girls. And Mary Ellsberg, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Shatarupa Barua.
Thank you.
Well, Mary Ellsberg, first I'd like to get your reaction to the UN report that was released this month about violence against women. And, of course, this is the 20th anniversary after the Beijing Conference on Women. Just to elaborate a bit more on this report, it says that about 35% of women worldwide, that is more than one in three, said they experienced physical violence in their lifetime. One in 10 girls under the age of 18 was forced to have sex. So, again, we are witnessing some sort of an upsurge in violence.
Well, actually, it's not clear that we're witnessing an upsurge. What we really are witnessing is that we have data for the first time to show that one in three women have been abused, and it's getting a lot more international attention. And as you mentioned, the context of this was the Commission on the Status of Women meeting, which I was at when they presented this report, and the idea was to find out how much we have achieved in the last 20 years since the Beijing Conference. And what we have achieved is that we have a lot more data on the issue, but it's not clear that this is actually an increase.
So we are being able to document it more, and so more of these terrible incidents are coming to light, and they stand in contrast to these gains in education, political power. I wonder to what extent the gains that women have made are perhaps fueling the violence. I mean, do women's very success, does that cause some sort of resentment and increase in these incidents?
It's certainly possible. In some cases, we've seen, for example, with microfinance programs in South Asia, where women start to get some income for the first time and get a little bit of power within the household, that can be very threatening to husbands, and it can lead to more domestic violence. But in fact, I would say that the gains are probably part of the solution. And if anything, in many places, violence is probably going down.
Well, indeed, and I certainly wasn't suggesting that we don't continue to progress, even if some of that causes resentment and challenges or threatens men. But I'd like now to turn to my colleague Shatarupa for another question.
Talking about successful women, in this day and age, a lot of women are very active, very successful in public sphere, and that includes social media as well. Ashley Judd, the actress, and obviously a basketball fan, during a March Madness game, she tweeted, "I think Arkansas is playing dirty." And then she was subjected to what she calls a tsunami of gender-based violence and misogyny. When a woman is attacked on the social media, in most cases, the attack takes the form of gendered insults and sexual assault threats. Why is that?
Well, I certainly experienced the same thing, not perhaps to the degree that Ashley Judd did, but when we put out a Lancet article recently about preventing violence against women, and when we released our original data talking about the one in three, the number of comments to the Lancet website and to op-ed pieces that we did in the Washington Post were astonishing. And to some degree, I think that men who are threatened by women's gains are particularly well organized and particularly vocal. Perhaps 8-to-1 of the messages are men saying that, you know, women deserve to be beaten, or what about all the battered men? Very ugly comments.
Digital platforms offer a certain anonymity or distance. Do you think if these men were given the FaceTime with these women, they would be able to make this kind of comments to their faces?
I think it depends on the circumstances. I mean, we see a lot of very ugly responses in face-to-face encounters and sexual harassment on buses and in public spaces. And women are beginning to talk out about that as well. But I do agree that social media platforms are a particularly good place to be anonymous and to sort of let everybody's, their deepest, most evil thoughts out.
You mentioned the public places like public buses, public transportations. I think, please correct me if I'm wrong, everybody in this room have been subjected to some kind of verbal harassment in public places on a number of occasions, whether it's the new market in Dhaka, the capital city of Bangladesh, or the Union Station here in D.C., the capital of the United States. And I also like to think that I am somewhat empowered than a lot more women out there. Even then, I tend to shrug some of it off as compliments. Some I find offensive. Some keep me wondering whether I have been violated in some ways or not. Why do we take this kind of everyday form of patriarchal aggression and don't do anything about it?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that women and girls have been raised to expect this kind of treatment. And in fact, if they get upset about it or if they tell somebody, somebody inevitably asks, what were you wearing? Why were you out late at night? And we as a society tend to always blame the victims or the women being abused rather than the abusers. And that's part of this whole rape culture as it's now being referred to. I should say, though, that there are many social media programs that are actually addressing this issue now. For example, in India, there's a program called Safety Pin. It's a mobile app where women can talk about experiences of harassment and use the GPS on their phone to say, this is what happened to me here. And women can sort of share experiences and know that this is a place they shouldn't go, for example. And there's several apps like that that are based on social media platforms but are actually helping to empower women and keep them safe.
Let me remind our listeners that you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Mary Ellsberg. She's the founding director of the Global Women's Institute at George Washington University. We're talking about violence against women worldwide, its causes, consequences, and what more can be done to combat it. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, along with Shatarupa Barua from VOA's Bangla service. Well, turning back to you, Mary Ellsberg, let's get back to what you think are the major factors in developed and developing societies that are leading to so much disrespect, harassment, and of course, violence in the form of rape or murder against women.
When we started this research over 20 years ago, we were looking for individual risk factors. For example, what is it about specific women that make them more likely to be abused? Or what is it about specific men that would make them more likely to be abusers? And we looked at childhood experiences, economic experiences and background. And the more studies we've done around the world, the more we are convinced that it's not an issue of your individual background or characteristics. Violence is a product of the social norms in the society that we live in. And a huge amount of violence takes place simply because men are raised to believe that they should dominate their wives. And if their wives misbehave, they should chastise them. And it's absolutely culturally considered appropriate. And we think that's really the biggest driver.
So if that's the biggest driver, then what are the ways that we can change this phenomenon to prevent this violence? What are the strategies?
Well, that's a great question. Once we realize that this is really a societal problem and a problem of social norms rather than individuals, then the solutions we've been using for the last 20 or 30 years, like batters, interventions, or just having shelters for women, which is very important, but it doesn't solve the problem. we realize that we need to do something completely new. And this is where really the Global South is leading the way and has had developed. There are many groups that are developing interventions, programs that are based on community dialogue and not just talking to men or women, but talking to everybody in the community about values and talking about ways that violence hurts families and communities and how becoming nonviolent and finding new ways to communicate and balance power within relationships, how that can actually provide for so much more satisfaction for men as well as women.
And Mary Ellsberg, to what extent do you think women actually perpetuate misogyny, this hatred of women, perhaps inadvertently? Do mothers inadvertently favor their boys because of whether religious norms or values that they have not questioned? Because we see that across cultures and nations that, you know, women seem to favor their boys over their girls. And this just perpetuates the attitudes that we're seeing that lead to violence and disrespect.
Well, it's certainly true that women hold the same values in general as the rest of society. So I wouldn't say that they are perpetuating it in a way that's different from the way that everybody else perpetuates it. They were trained to believe that they're inferior to men, that they should be submissive, that men have the right to beat them. In fact, in our studies, we found that sometimes 50 to 80% of the women that we interview, including women who have been beaten themselves, believe that men have a right to beat their wives over things like not having the food ready on time or refusing sex, which is a major trigger for violence. And they believe that that's justified. So again, it's not a specific group that needs to change. It's everybody.
But particularly women, it seems to me, they need to try to reverse these notions. And somehow we need to inculcate greater self-esteem and other values so that they can help be part of the change.
Well, no matter how empowered women are, they don't have control over whether men are beating them. So again, I would say we need to work with the men so that they stop using these behaviors and understand they're unacceptable. And yes, women have to believe that they don't deserve this and that violence is never justified and stop blaming themselves when they get beaten, which is what usually happens.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Mary Ellsberg. She's the founding director of the Global Women's Institute at George Washington University here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is Shatarupa Barua. She's a broadcaster in VOA's Bangla service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a very faithful listener in Kabul, Shaista Khan Ahmadzai. And now a question from Shatarupa.
Carol mentioned the hugely publicized Delhi rape. And there is this documentary, India's Daughter, the BBC documentary, which has sparked protests and debates in India and around the world. Some Indian scholars and activists have criticized the documentary for portraying India as a brutal, backward, and patriarchal society. Then Indian government puts a ban on the documentary. Indian's government's decision to impose a ban on the documentary helps us or hurts us in women's cause?
I think that's a difficult question to answer, particularly for someone living in the United States. I did meet in New York at the Commission on the Status of Women meeting with several members of the Indian women's movement, and I did see parts, not all, of the documentary of India's Daughter. And I can completely understand why they were very much against having it aired, particularly because they were worried about how this might affect the trials and the appeals of the defendants, of the accused. In terms of making India look bad, I don't think that would be a reason for banning it. I think what it really shows very clearly, although it does put a lot of emphasis on the voices of the abusers, and it was very shocking to hear how they spoke about women and, you know, women basically being bad people. Any girl who goes out at night deserves whatever she gets. There was no remorse. However, when you see it, you don't develop any sympathy at all for the accused. You really understand that they represent broader ideas and social norms. And certainly you don't understand that everybody believes this way, but that a lot of people do, and that that's something that has to change if we're ever going to change violence against women.
So do we take a stand on universal right of women, or do we maintain sensitivity to different cultures?
No, I believe that women's rights are human rights and that those are universal. So the fact that something is promoted or presented by culture doesn't, in my view, mean that it's acceptable. And now I refer to the language of local women activists, both in India and many other societies where tradition and culture is often used as an excuse for violence. And they always point to elements in their culture, particularly historically, that actually favor women and that are not as oppressive to women as the way they're being used right now. And also to the way that cultures change, and cultures are very dynamic. And there's no reason that we should accept a cultural belief that harms or denigrates any human being.
Well, Mary Ellsberg, another graphic and very despicable incident occurred recently in Afghanistan, in Kabul. We read about a theology student, Farkunda. She was brutally beaten with rocks and sticks before being run over by a car in front of one of Kabul's most venerated shrines after an Islamic preacher accused her of desecrating the Quran. And then her bloodied body was set on fire and tossed into the Kabul River. The police evidently were at the scene but did nothing to stop the mob. This is under investigation. But this is just another example, egregious example of violence against women, where you have law enforcement authorities standing by, doing nothing. Again, what are ways we can combat this? Because even laws on the books don't seem to be enough, because they are either not implemented or enforced.
Definitely having laws on the books is absolutely vital. And the last 20 years have been really notable in that for the first time, we do have over 123 laws that are criminalizing domestic violence around the world. But it's absolutely not enough. So many of these laws are just written in the books and never referred to again. They're not implemented. They're not funded. And they don't overnight change the culture of the police force, the judiciary, and people on the street. What was encouraging from what I've heard about what happened in Kabul was, first of all, the police now have been arrested and are being investigated, and also that there was a huge outpouring of public outrage. And I heard that women were on the street in a way that they never have been before. The same happened in India after the Delhi rapes. And I think that's where we see social change coming. The fact that these things happened before and nothing was ever said. It's really not the first time that horrific acts of violence are being carried out in public. It's really the first time that women and men together are taking to the streets and saying, this is absolutely intolerable and we won't accept it.
And even in the Afghanistan incident, I read somewhere that some women came out and actually broke the custom and buried the body.
Exactly. So I heard that, and they carried the remains of the woman. Exactly. So, again, showing that when customs and tradition don't favor the human rights of everybody and don't support everybody in a community, they have to change. And I think many people are coming to realize that.
Some silver lining amid the terrible acts of violence. Mary Ellsberg, another question regarding what anyone would consider some sort of violence and disrespect to women. Customs of female genital mutilation, for example, or even marital rape. As I said, these practices most women would find abhorrent and would fall into the category of violence against women, but they do persist in many societies with impunity. So what do you see is happening with respect to fighting against female genital mutilation and marital rape?
So starting with female genital mutilation, which is very common, and it's estimated over 80 million women and girls have undergone the practice around the world. In most cases, definitely to the families who are doing it, they do not see themselves as committing acts of violence against their daughters. In fact, they feel that they're preparing them for marriage. And in fact, if one person, and this is again where you see where it's entire communities that need to get involved, if one family decided not to cut their daughter, she would not be able to get married in many places, and she would be absolutely stigmatized. So what we've seen as really successful programs, for example, the Tostan program, which started in Senegal and has been now used in many parts of Africa, is to get the entire community talking about FGM and to understand how this affects their daughters negatively, talk about the terrible health effects, particularly when she grows up and has sex for the first time or when she's giving birth, and start saying, you know, we don't need this. We don't want this for our girls, and taking village level pledges to stop cutting their daughters. If they do that and then they share with other villages nearby with whom they're marrying, the girls are getting married, and get them and encourage them to do the same. That's how you can change a practice that seems deeply entrenched, but you can change it quickly. And we saw the same thing with foot binding in China, which completely ended over a generation or two. Although it is a big challenge, we really do believe that it is possible to end these kinds of practices.
And what about marital rape?
Well, marital rape is actually not even a concept in many places. When we were doing research on this subject in Nicaragua with rural women, and we said, does your husband ever oblige you to have sex? They looked at us like, what are you talking about? You know, it is our obligation to have sex with our husbands whenever they want. And the idea of being forced to do it doesn't really make sense. Now, in fact, when in our studies we have found, when we say, did your husband ever force you to have sex or do something you didn't want to, we find that between 15 and 35% of women say that that has happened to them, and it's had a huge impact on their mental health and their physical health. But part of what we need to do is really shine a light on what is going on and start to change ideas about what is acceptable within marriage and what isn't.
And that leads me to another follow-on. For example, in Nigeria, there are laws on the books that permit a man to beat his wife under certain circumstances. Again, this is on that spectrum of what is, in some cultures, acceptable levels of violence against women. How can this be squared or reconciled with women's rights, human rights?
Well, I'm not familiar with the Nigerian law, but in fact, most African nations now do have laws against domestic violence. Many of them, as I said, are not enforced or they're not comprehensive. But that's not because every country or every parliament has decided independently that they should do something about it. It's because of international world pressure, both at the level of the UN. The Beijing conference was a huge factor. But there's also research showing that the countries that have the best laws on domestic violence are the countries that have the strongest social movements for women. So it's also pushing from below has a huge impact on these laws.
And let's hope that that will continue to grow.
Absolutely.
Okay, now developed world.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We are not immune.
Not at all. So Rolling Stone article about this University of Virginia student who got raped in her freshman year. That created a lot of debates, a lot of controversies in the media. And later on, the credibility of the article was questioned. And while we are doubting Ms. Edeley's journalistic ethics, we are all painfully aware of the fact that campus rapes happen, and whether it's the University of Virginia or it's Harvard. And now White House is addressing it. And my question is about the White House Task Force report called Not Alone. The report listed a number of recommendations, and one of the recommendations was to encourage universities to engage their male students and encourage them to step in when someone is in trouble and be part of the solution. So to what extent do you think the bystander intervention solution is effective?
We don't have much evidence yet to say whether it's effective or not, but it certainly seems promising. We see so many cases of violence, or even just hateful speech, or men talking to each other about, you know, things they've done to women. And other men don't intervene because they feel like it's not cool. They feel like maybe everybody will criticize them. And we've now done research that shows that most men don't think that this is good, and they don't feel comfortable when men or their buddies are denigrating other women. And so encouraging them to speak up and to become, now they talk about them as being upstanders instead of bystanders, I think is a really positive idea and really innovative. And we've seen on the campus of George Washington University a lot of interest on the part of men to publicly stand against sexual violence on campus. We recently had an event where we were launching the UN's He for She campaign on our campus, and we have not had a lot of success in really getting male students involved in our activities before, but we thought, okay, this time we're really going to make the focus on the male students and invite them to participate. And we were really surprised. We had an event with standing room only. Many fraternities came, the entire fraternity, with their shirts on and took this pledge to not use violence against others and to speak up when others were using violence. And they were just really grateful to have and very excited to have a movement that they could side with and really put themselves to challenge the ongoing status quo. So we found that very encouraging.
What kind of systems do you think we can put in place so that we can hold the university authorities more accountable to this?
Well, happily, we already have systems in place. We have Title IX, which says that no educational institution can discriminate against women because of their sex. And this is now being used to actually litigate, and many universities right now are under investigation for violations of Title IX. So basically, if they're not watching out for what's happening to their female students, and if they're not appropriately addressing sexual assault on campus, they are now considered to be in violation of Title IX and can be fined and can be sued. So again, we see that it is holding institutions accountable and popular movements that I think together can create the change.
Back to the individual level, Mary Ellsberg, we know that these fraternities and the parties with flowing alcohol lubricate this trend toward violence against women. But what can women do in the meantime? Because it's going to take a while for men to change their attitudes, particularly in these fraternities on campuses. To what extent should women be perhaps much more aware and cognizant of how they inadvertently invite, and again, I am not in any way blaming the victim, but just for their own protection, whether it's limiting the amount of alcohol they consume, going in groups so that they can take care of each other, are there ways that women can help to prevent the violence that is being directed toward them?
So now I'll speak as the mother of two college-age girls. Of course I'm worried about them. I would never suggest that they curtail their aspirations. I think one thing that is helpful, I think, for college women is to realize that it could happen to them and that nobody is immune. And I think that's really shocking to realize that one out of five college women get raped on campus. But I think it's very dangerous to talk about measures that girls should take so that they aren't victimized. We need to keep the focus very squarely on the abusers and their behavior change.
Mary Ellsberg, just quickly summarize for us what you think is an important multi-pronged approach to diminishing violence against women.
Well, Carol, I think you said the most important word up front, which is multi-pronged. And what we really know about preventing violence against women is that no one measure is going to do it. It takes everybody working together. And we've seen some wonderful programs in, for example, Uganda, the SASA program of community mobilization, which actually managed to reduce the prevalence of domestic violence by 50% over a two-year period just by engaging everybody, religious leaders, medical personnel, community men and women, young people, and talking more, and as I said earlier, talking about alternatives to violence. And they were very successful, and that makes me hopeful that other communities and other nations could do the same.
Mary Ellsberg is the founding director of the Global Women's Institute at George Washington University. Mary Ellsberg, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insights.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and I'm Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program was Shatarupa Barua, a broadcaster in VOA's Bangla service. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.